This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Doug Gurian-Sherman. He's Director of Sustainable Agriculture and Senior Scientist at the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
We're here today to talk about glyphosate, also known as Monsanto Roundup, which is a chemical used in agriculture, but also in other applications as well. What is it? How is it used in the United States?
Well, glyphosate is a herbicide or weed killer. It's now the most widely used herbicide in the world, largely due to its use on genetically engineered crops like soybean, corn, cotton, and so forth. Those are huge acreage crops in the U.S. and elsewhere, and glyphosate is now by far the dominant herbicide used on those crops and others. So it's a weed killer, and it's a very effective one until it's abused, as it is with the current crops not properly regulated, in which case we have now a huge epidemic of weeds that have developed resistance to this herbicide and made it ineffective on probably at least 60 or 70 million acres of cropland in the U.S. That's an area about the size of Wyoming.
It sounds like the kind of problem that you have with resistant strains of bacteria to antibiotics.
It has a lot of parallels to that. I mean, when you expose an organism to something that can kill it, but not necessarily kill every member of the species, there's often either some genetic changes or rare genetic properties in some members of those species that confer resistance. So whether it's antibiotics or insecticides or herbicides in this case, yes, it's basically accelerated evolution that we contribute to, and we contribute to it as we do with antibiotics by a lot of practices that should be changed. We greatly overuse these herbicides. We don't need to overuse them. We can do highly productive agriculture without overusing them. And when you use them more judiciously, it's not only better, you know, in terms of avoiding harmful exposure to people in the environment, it also preserves whatever use you may legitimately want those chemicals to have.
Right, right. The use of glyphosate has increased a great deal in the last decade or so, or a little longer than that. I mean, it was invented, I guess, in the 1970s. How is it being used, and why the great increase? What does this look like?
Yeah, so according to probably our most recent data from the U.S. Geological Survey, the use has gone up really tremendously over the last 20 years, and essentially, again, it's almost all driven by genetically engineered crops that have been engineered to be immune to the herbicide. So, for example, the U.S. Geological Survey's data shows that in the couple years prior to the introduction of these crops commercially in the mid-1990s, we were using about 20 or 30 million pounds of glyphosate a year in the U.S., which sounds like a lot, and it is. But now we're using about 300 million pounds, so 10 times as much. And almost all of that, the large majority of it, is being used to douse these engineered crops. You know, most of the uses of those are for animal feed or, in some cases, biofuels, but we do consume it, you know, in products, and it does get in the air and water as well.
Well, let's talk about that. What happens to it, and what happens to the living organisms it touches when it gets into the land, air, and water? First of all, let's start at the bottom. Let's start with soil. What does the application of this herbicide do to the soil that the plants are growing in on which this stuff is sprayed?
Well, that's an interesting question where we don't have as much data as would be nice to have. There are some experiments that suggest that it can be harmful to some soil microorganisms. There's certainly soil microorganisms that are susceptible to it and they'll be killed by it. The difficulty is that glyphosate usually breaks down relatively quickly, or most of it does. There's going to be some residues that stick around longer. But in most typical soils, it breaks down pretty quickly, and most microorganisms reproduce quite quickly. So typically, it's used, you know, two or three times a year now on field. So it'll break down within a, you know, a week or two, or most of it will. And the microorganisms that may be harmed can rebound pretty quickly. So it's unclear how much harm it's causing to the soil directly. But the kind of farming practices that it encourages are not overall good for the soil. The use of herbicides as opposed to what we should be doing instead to control weeds using ecologically smart agriculture that utilizes the diversity of nature, and I can explain that at some point, that does not rely heavily or at all on these herbicides, is much better for the soil. So I think it's important to look at the direct effects of any kind of agricultural chemicals on human health and the environment, but there's incredibly important indirect effects in terms of the kinds of agriculture that they encourage and the effects of those different types of agriculture on both the environment and health. And the kind of an agriculture that is clearly best for the soil and many other aspects of the environment, something we call agroecology, or basically growing food based on the very sophisticated science of ecology, minimizes the use of these chemicals and maximizes the use of cover crops and manures and mulches and a diversity of crops that contribute to fertile soil and build soil fertility, which has a lot of important positive properties. Now, those that have argued for the benefits of genetically engineered crops and even these herbicide-resistant crops have argued that it facilitates what we call conservation tillage or no-till. So tilling is plowing, and while small amounts of judicious plowing can be fine, especially if, again, combined with ecologically sound farming principles, over-tilling, over-plowing, as often has been done in the past, contributes to soil erosion and so forth. And it has been claimed that these crops and glyphosate and Roundup Ready crops, the engineered crops, have contributed to the adoption by many, many farmers of conservation tillage. And conservation tillage is a good thing overall, especially in terms of soil erosion and the ability of soil to absorb water, rainwater, or something that falls on, as opposed to running off. But as we have at Center for Food Safety have documented for years, based on published data, scientific data, and as the National Academy of Sciences just confirmed in the report released yesterday, there is no clear link between these crops and the use of glyphosate and increases in conservation tillage. So one of the major purported benefits of these crops has been shot down now by the National Academy of Sciences in the report that they just put out. So in summary, it's hard to tell how much harm these herbicides may be doing directly to the soil, but the kinds of industrial agriculture that they have helped support are certainly not good for the soil and have probably made it harder to adopt the kinds of ecologically based agriculture that we really need, you know, to preserve the soil.
We're talking to Doug Gurian-Sherman of the Center for Food Safety. Let's talk about glyphosate with respect to what it does to creatures, to bees, pollinators, amphibians, little guys who live in the water, things like that.
Well, again, we have to distinguish between direct effects, you know, the toxicity of the herbicide directly. As well, there's other chemicals that are almost always there with the herbicides, adjuvants, surfactants, that EPA has called in the past inert ingredients. They're not inert, and some of them are more toxic than the pesticides themselves. One of those had been implicated in harming amphibians in the past. Now, in the U.S., I think all or virtually all of the types of formulations of glyphosate have removed that particular surfactant, but there are many others, and we don't really have enough data to know how harmful they are. But again, the indirect but very important impacts of glyphosate becoming more and more well understood. So, you know, one of probably the most dramatic is the probable impact it has had on monarch butterflies. Monarch butterflies, which, you know, most people are familiar with, the big orange and black butterflies that are really amazing as being the insect that has the world record for migration. It'll go from, you know, southern Canada in the late summer and fall all the way to central Mexico in the mountains south of Mexico City. Really amazing, as well as the, you know, the butterflies themselves being beautiful and amazing butterflies. Their populations have dived dramatically in the last 20 years, coincident with the introduction and increase in Roundup Ready engineered crops and the use of this herbicide on them. And the most likely culprit is that Roundup glyphosate is a very effective herbicide in killing the only food that monarch larvae, you know, their caterpillars, rely on, you know, when they're reproducing. So we've killed off over 90%, probably higher, more, of the milkweed in the Midwest, the Corn Belt, which is the region that monarchs have historically most used to build up their populations in the summer. And so we basically use Roundup, you know, in these crops to kill off the main food supply of their young. The bulk of the best research from our perspective by far supports and substantiates the connection between the loss of milkweed due to this herbicide and the tremendous decline of monarchs. We actually have a petition to the U.S. government, Fish and Wildlife Service, Department of the Interior, proposing to list monarchs as threatened or endangered because their loss has been so dramatic. So that, you know, that is pretty clear. Monarchs are a pollinator. They're probably not a super overall important one. But as Lincoln Brower, who is the preeminent monarch biologist in the world, has said, you know, these monarchs are really kind of like a canary in the cornfields. We track monarchs. We spend a lot of time studying them. We don't spend nearly that much time studying other important wildlife, insects, and so forth. And so what's happening to monarchs is not likely to be unique, because what ends up happening is these herbicides, they kill off weeds in fields. They also drift onto nearby areas, and there's a lot of research showing that they kill off flowers and so forth that beneficial insects like pollinators need near fields, and in, especially in places like the Midwest, where they're dominated by corn and soybeans, there aren't a lot of areas that are uncultivated, and those areas become even more important to this wildlife. And so that's, you know, one pretty clear, I think, harm to one kind of pollinator that these crops do. But again, these crops are likely contributing to more industrialization of farms, larger farm size, simpler and simpler farming landscapes that have less and less diversity that supports, you know, pollinators and butterflies and, you know, all of
right.
these wonderful insects.
And it's interesting because, I mean, one of the other big threats to monarch butterflies is the kind of pesticide called neonicotinoids. And
yes.
those are pesticides. They kill insects. But then you don't even think of herbicides, which aren't meant to kill insects, but they kill the plants that the insects need to live.
That's
and you
right.
have to think about that when you think about the land we live on as a series of ecosystems, as a bunch of discrete units to be managed.
Well, yeah, and that's right. And the point you bring up about neonics is important. You know, we need to look at all of these things together. And, you know, in general, glyphosate and the neonicotinoid insecticides and fungicides and so forth are all part of an industrial agriculture system that has been successful in part because it's highly productive, in part because we spend billions of dollars of subsidies propping it up every year, taxpayer money, and in part because our research establishment has devoted almost all of its, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year to prop it up. And very little research has shown, probably only roughly 5% of our research budget goes to developing the efficiency and so forth of these ecologically based farming methods. So as a scientist, I'm not surprised that the industrial methods are more efficient. We've spent over a period of decades billions and billions of dollars making it more efficient and virtually nothing improving these ecologically based farming methods that don't rely on herbicides and other pesticides. And yet, research at some of our best land-grant universities, for example, Iowa State University and others, have shown that these ecologically based methods are not only really good for the environment in terms of both the pollinators and other insects, but also water quality and air quality and soil quality, but they're also actually more productive than industrial agriculture, and they're more profitable to farmers. So it's really crazy that we're not doing this. It is more complicated. Farmers would need help transitioning to these things, and it's understandable that they don't want to do it on their own. They do what they've done for decades and know how to do. But the government, this is a legitimate thing that the government should be doing instead of propping up chemical-based, fossil fuel-based industrial agriculture, which is killing the landscape and not sustainable. We should be using those subsidies and research instead to move to what we know works, which is ecologically based farming systems, and importantly, can be quite profitable to farmers.
We're talking to Doug Gurian-Sherman from the Center for Food Safety in Washington. So let's talk about glyphosate and Roundup, which is our topic today, and what it does if it does reach people and animals. I mean, you say that it does break down eventually, but what happens when people are exposed to it, either the people who are applying it, or maybe it stays in crops that we eat, or maybe it stays, I don't know, but in the cotton that is grown using this herbicide and then becomes our clothes, or we buy it ourselves from Home Depot and spray it in our yards, or cities buy it and they spray it in parks or on the cracks between the sidewalks. How does it actually affect people when they're exposed to it?
Yeah, so that's, of course, a very good question, and it's something that the regulators are struggling with, especially since about a year ago, the probably most authoritative international agency on cancer, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is part of the World Health Organization, determined based on its assessment of all of the scientific literature, the published peer-reviewed scientific literature, that glyphosate is probably a carcinogen. For years, the companies and many of my colleagues who are staunch advocates for genetically engineered crops and industrial agriculture have responded to the dramatic increase in glyphosate use that I mentioned earlier, saying, well, it's replacing other herbicides that are more toxic, and glyphosate is relatively benign, and so forth. Now what's been revealed by the IARC is that it's likely not nearly so benign, which is a real conundrum. So this is this was a body of 17 highly qualified independent scientists, toxicologists, epidemiologists. It was led by one of the former senior scientists of the National Cancer Institute, National Institute of Health in the U.S. This was not, some junk science body, but the first thing Monsanto said — Monsanto is one of the main producers of glyphosate and the seeds that are immune to it — is basically that this was junk science, which is just absolutely ridiculous. I guess not surprising, since they were attacking a sacred cow in a way here.
Well, they want to sell it.
Well, of course. So it's very controversial. U.S. EPA, where I used to work as a scientist years ago, is in the middle of reevaluating the safety of glyphosate. They've postponed several times their assessment. EFSA, the European Food Safety Agency, with data from a German group that was informed largely by scientists with industry ties, and that did not look at all of the data and also used a lot of non-published data to review the safety of glyphosate, decided that it was probably not a carcinogen, which has been very controversial. And more recently, another part of the UN said that the amounts that people are exposed to through diet probably are not carcinogenic. They did not say it was not a carcinogen, but when you consider the safety of a chemical, it's both the hazard, or how toxic it is per se, and then how much you're exposed to and over what period of time. And their assessment was that people through diet are not exposed enough. There's, I think, some important caveats to that. One is they were talking about diet, and some of the data that IARC used, the epidemiological data, showed that farmers and farm workers and their families have considerably higher rates of certain cancers. And so that exposure is probably not through diet. It's probably through exposure from, you know, applying the glyphosate. So not surprisingly, the people most at risk are farmers and farm workers. And we should have, I think, regardless of whether we are, some concern about our fellow citizens. They are certainly at probably the highest risk. But interestingly, you know, at least one study showed that other people not using the farm chemicals had as high levels of glyphosate in their blood and urine as farmers and farm workers did. So that is in and of itself troubling.
How did they get exposed to it?
Well, you know, a lot of this, you know, if it's in farm country, it's definitely been shown to be in the air, in rain, in water, and some residues on food. So, you know, people, especially in farm country, in that part of the country, certainly can be exposed to it, but people in any part of the country can be exposed to it to some extent. So anyway, it's not entirely certain how much risk there is, but the IARC is a very authoritative body. They were unanimous in their decision that this was a probable carcinogen, and we heard through discussions that they were close to calling it a known carcinogen, which is their highest risk category. And so I think that's definitely disconcerting. I think you also have to consider that while the, you know, the assessments of the regulatory agencies are pretty good in several ways, there are several things they don't really account for. One is that we're rarely exposed to only one pesticide at a time. There are often residues of other pesticides as well that we're exposed to. And more and more literature is showing that those often have additive or multiplicative or synergistic effects. So the small amounts of different pesticides all, you know, exposed to together can have effects that no one of them would have by itself at low doses. And unfortunately, EPA and other agencies do not assess the potential harm to human health from exposure to multiple different pesticides at the same time, even though that's what usually happens. So I think there's some real caveats. I think, you know, in sum, it's prudent to avoid exposure to glyphosate. You know, it's one of these things where it's a complicated issue to assess, but I think, again, it's likely, the best assessment at this point is that it's likely to be a carcinogen, more likely than not. At exactly what dose, I don't want to cut it that close personally. I mean, you know, my feeling is, you know, if you have a chemical that is likely to be a carcinogen, the best thing to do is try to avoid it entirely.
There's also this question of when you have glyphosate-resistant weeds, and you talked about that earlier in the program, what happens then? Do you have to use more of it? So successively each year or each sort of five-year period, are farmers buying more of it and applying more of it to their fields?
Yes, and that's a great question. And, you know, again, it reflects on the unsustainability of this type of agriculture because, you know, you get resistant weeds and to other chemicals you get resistant, you know, insects to insecticides and fungi to fungicides. But in the case of the weeds, yes, I mean, the data has shown rising use per acre of glyphosate as weeds become more resistant, and also shifting to other herbicides because once they become resistant, the glyphosate doesn't control those weeds anymore, so other herbicides have to be used, but glyphosate still works well on other weeds. So what tends to happen is farmers don't stop using glyphosate, which is a fairly inexpensive herbicide. They add others. And in fact, the answer of the industry to this epidemic of glyphosate-resistant weeds, which is really causing havoc in a number of parts of the country because they're so hard to control, is a new generation of crops that are resistant to old herbicides like 2,4-D that were developed in the 1940s and which also have a spotty, at best, health record and are even more prone to drift and cause damage off the farm. And so what the industry has done is engineered crops now to be immune to old herbicides like 2,4-D and dicamba and others. And so what we're facing now and what weed scientists have said is probably a doubling or tripling, if these things go into effect, further doubling or tripling of overall herbicide use to control these resistant weeds. And, of course, the companies are not necessarily, you know, unhappy about that because they're selling
right.
more herbicides and more charging more for the seeds and so forth. There are probably limits to how much they can do with that because, I mean, if the crop prices don't go up enough, the farmers can't, you know, indefinitely keep paying more and more and more for these products. But there's probably still room for them to – they're probably willing and room for them to pay more and use more than they're using now. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's been called for many years the pesticide treadmill, and I think we now have a genetic engineering treadmill – for those kind of crops, which are on, you know, the main thing that the industry has been interested in and are, you know, waiting in the wings. And again, you know, we have these wonderful ecologically based alternatives that our government should be incentivizing, encouraging, doing research on to make them more farmer-friendly, giving farmers information on how to transition to them and so forth. But instead, we just keep going down this well-worn and unsustainable path.
Well, and it's so tricky because economically, I mean, I haven't done the math on this exactly, but what it sounds like is farmers have to pay more and more and more for these herbicides and pesticides and genetically engineered seeds and all of this stuff. That reflects itself in the price they have to charge, but they're subsidized by taxpayers. So instead of paying for it at the supermarket, we're paying for it more invisibly on our tax bill, but either way, we're paying for what essentially amounts to Monsanto's profits.
Absolutely, and we're paying for it in terms of our tax, but we're also paying for it in terms of damage to the environment.
Yeah.
And so we're paying for it in multiple ways, and you're absolutely right, because it doesn't show up necessarily directly in the cost of food. People, you know, may not get upset about it, but we are paying for it. There's, you know, as the saying goes, there's no free lunch. You know, we pay for it one way or another, through higher medical bills, through harm to the environment, and the higher costs that farmers pay and our taxes. But yes, I mean, it's been shown that, you know, that the seed costs have gone up dramatically because of these things, you know, anywhere from 50% to double or triple in cost. And farmers have been able to get by somewhat because for the last 8 or 10 years, we've had historically high corn and soybean prices. They've been going down, but they're still higher than they were before. That may not continue. So they've been willing to pay, you know, somewhat higher prices for these seeds and the pesticides up till now. But what has been shown that even when they're getting higher prices, the companies are taking a bigger percentage of the farmer's profit. They used to pay, you know, 10, 15 years ago, about 8 or 9, roughly 9% of their variable cost in seed, and now it's up to between 15 and 20%. So the companies are getting richer, they're charging more, the farmers are scraping by, a lot are going out of business and consolidating because their margins are smaller per acre, and the only way they can keep their heads above water is to get bigger and bigger. And so it's really on many levels. And then, you know, our rural communities empty out because there's fewer people working on farms that are bigger and bigger. And so, you know, from many perspectives, this is, you know, the kind of agriculture we do that's based on things like overuse of glyphosate in these crops is really a social and environmental disaster. And unfortunately, a lot of it is what we've, you know, called flyover country. And, you know, 30, 40 years ago, Iowa grew 30-plus crops. Now it's almost all corn and soybeans. I grew up in the Midwest in Michigan, and in many ways it used to be a beautiful part of the country, and we've sacrificed a lot of it. But it, you know, it adds up because what happens in the farms in Iowa goes downstream and causes the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and the Chesapeake Bay and so on that reduces our marine, you know, fisheries and causes the pollution in Lake Erie that raises the drinking water costs of the citizens of Toledo and on and on and on. We do pay for it.
What does all this mean for farmers? I mean, the word farmers is such a big embrace, and I think it's important to make distinctions between somebody who has a 10-acre farm, a 100-acre farm, a 1,000-acre farm, or these vast swaths that, I mean, we've talked to Craig Childs on this show, who spent something like 2 days trying to walk from one end of a cornfield in Iowa to the other, and I don't even know if he got there. I mean, these huge farms. What are you hearing from these different sectors of farmers? I mean, there is on the small farm end this huge movement toward regenerative agriculture, or agroecology, as you are calling it, and going not only to organic, but I mean beyond organic, to a real ecosystem based kind of farming, which I think many of us find very interesting. But what about on the big farms? Are you hearing a kind of frustration with the herbicide and pesticide treadmill that you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, you hear different things. I mean, some farmers defend it. You know, they say it reduces labor and makes life easier for them. Others feel very uneasy about it. You know, they feel like they've lost control. You know, one farmer said, I'm not a farmer, I'm a manager. You know, I manage this property. And he said it pretty wistfully. You know, his father was a farmer, and I've talked to other farmers, and they feel kind of trapped because they're on this treadmill. They're also often, although, you know, on a debt treadmill, you know, buying bigger equipment and so forth. And it makes the farmers, even the biggest farms, are usually squeezed. They're big, but they don't have nearly the economic power that the Monsantos and DuPonts and the suppliers of the pesticides and seeds on the one hand have, you know, the farm equipment, or on the other, the retailers that take the food, the Cargills and the ADMs and the processors. And so that's why, for example, you know, we're seeing the seed costs taking up a bigger percentage of farmer profit. You know, they're being squeezed. And so they're kind of trapped, too, even these bigger farmers. And, again, it's not, you know, it's risky from their perspective to, you know, even if they want to just say, I'm going to try to farm a different way. What do they do with those huge combines? And what do they do with, you know, the system they have in place? Where do they find the extra labor? So this is something we know needs to be done. We know it can work. And again, instead of incentivizing stupid things like industrial agriculture that are harmful on so many levels and unsustainable, we should do what we need to help those farmers, you know, transition. And again, you know, some of them, this is all they're used to. As a matter of fact, some weed scientists at a conference called them glyphosate babies because they haven't known any other way to farm. And so there needs to be a whole change in the system that doesn't victimize farmers. They're already victimized in some ways. And for farmers that are willing to encourage them to change and help them change what they do, and to penalize over time, you know, the bad practices that are causing harm to everyone in the environment. So we need to make it, you know, more viable, more supportive of farmers to do the right thing, and then begin to also penalize these practices that are costing us as a society.
Glyphosate, as you say, is mainly used by agriculture, but it is also used in cities and by consumers. What is your recommendation as a scientist at the Center for Food Safety and as a scientist in general for people who want to control weeds on that kind of scale, an urban scale or a backyard garden scale?
Yeah, well, it's a dilemma. I mean, personally, you know, again, that goes to various social mores and so forth about how you want your lawn to look and all of that. Personally, I would try to avoid using a chemical like glyphosate. Again, it's according to the most authoritative and independent group of scientists, a probable carcinogen. It doesn't mean if you get exposed to it once or twice using it around the house that you're likely to develop cancer, but again, you know, if something is known to be harmful, better to avoid it if you can than to use it. At least that's, you know, that's my perspective. There may be some very limited applications that could be justified, if not glyphosate, other herbicides and ones that maybe are not known or suspected carcinogens, you know, to control invasive species in some cases or whatever. But at the very least, we should use these chemicals very cautiously, with the assumption that they do cause harm to people in the environment, at Center for Food Safety, we, you know, advocate highly restricting the use of these pesticides for agriculture and for the general public.
Doug Gurian-Sherman is Director of Sustainable Agriculture. He's a senior scientist at the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.